everybody. This is Armand DeMille with Dr. Sherry Siegel, with you at The Positive Mind, a program meant to bring you ideas, concepts, and guests to help you lead a more positively minded life. Hey, friends, listen. Happy birthday to... See? Right there, you did it. What did you do? You filled in the word you, right? Why do people fill things in? Did you ever notice when somebody's speaking and they're talking a little long and you want to talk for them? What is it that makes you want to converse for them? What makes you want to fill in the blanks? It's a phenomenon called filling in. Now we're going to go, let's see what this filling in is about, because I'm going to tell you it's about romance too. People fill in with romance all the time. People fill in spare time. People fill in their thinking. In fact, I think most dreaming is filling in. We're going to talk all about that. Right now, I'm going to start with Sherry. Thank you for being here once again.
Happy
as you are every Wednesday, but next one,
yes, right.
Sherry, let's talk about neurology. Let's talk about filling in. We are built as fill-ins. Every human is an automatic. How many cells are there in the human body? Want to guess?
Millions and millions.
Millions and millions, right? And of all the cells, how many neurons are there? You must have a number there. 525,473,1,200.
Exactly.
And six. Seven as we speak. I mean, what's it all about? Why do we have so many brain cells? Why do we have so many cells? Why do we have so many neurons? And what is a neuron anyway? Is a neuron, well, I always thought about a neuron. If you held your body out, if you put your two arms, and let's say you do it right now, you take your two arms and you stretch them out, right? And then you have five fingers on each hand. That's a neuron. The neuron is that thing that runs down the middle, your two arms, and what's at your fingertips. And what's at your fingertips, they call the dendrite. And they call the middle part that goes through it the axon. Am I doing okay so far, Doc?
You're doing great.
Thank you. Now, why do we have these neurons? What is it? Why don't we just have one nerve that runs all the way through? Because the body would not be as efficient, because it would have to use the same system over and over again. It's like I was going through Central Park and there's a gap, you know, there's a space in the road where the carriages go over and over again. Well, if you had only one neuron continuously, you could burn it out easily. But if you had myriad neurons that could connect from any angle, well, that's amazing. But then how does the human brain do this?
You know, the giant squid does have one big neuron, and so a lot of scientists study that squid because they can really see one huge neuron sending information back and forth. So it's a very instructive animal for neuroscience. But you're right, we have many neurons because we have a very complex brain, and we do many things. We think, we move, we plan, we see, we sense. So there's so much going on at once. We really need multiple systems and circuits to take all the information.
Oh, wait a minute now. Thank you very much. But doesn't the calamari feel the same way? No, I mean, doesn't the octopus have to do all those things too? It's an interesting kind of, why would he get away
now,
with one neuron?
Oh, you're thinking the giant squid?
Yeah.
Well, the giant squid probably has very important things to do: procreate, eat, protect him or herself, but doesn't have all of the complexity that we have dealing with the city and driving.
Interesting.
And Christmas trees and holidays and dealing with other people.
We just know that the squid is a simpler form.
Yeah,
it's a simpler form, and therefore could afford a simpler brain system, right? But
yes.
Here we are. We're talking about filling in, by the way, my friends. We're talking about brain fill-ins, and you're going to learn how this affects your love, your choice, your Christmas, your dreams. We're even going to talk about sleep and filling in, brain fill-ins. So what does the brain do, and how does this work? We have the axon and the dendrites. We have these nerves, and these nerves are near each other but not touching each other, right?
That's exactly right. There's a very important gap that all neurons need, and it's called the synapse. It's the space between the neurons and the nerves, or the nerve cells. So when one nerve cell wants to talk to the next nerve cell and send information up the line or down the line, what that nerve has to do is let out little packets of neurochemicals or neurotransmitters. They float across the synapse or the gap, and they activate the next neuron.
You could actually picture this. If you imagine the dendrite is your fingers, imagine you have fingernails, and your fingernails, at the fingernail point, there is a thing that synthesizes, right, that sends out a protein, and this protein becomes the neurotransmitter. So you can actually see that at your fingernails are doing this excretion of this liquid, this fluid that somehow makes the nerve jump the gap. Almost there, almost touched, but not touching. And then, by affecting the chemicals, by affecting the synapse, the nerve transmission takes place.
Exactly.
Now, so gap filling is what we do for a living. All of our life is about gap filling. So it's a very common thing. Now, why is this such a big deal? Talk about what happens when somebody visualizes something on a wall.
Well, for example, we have a very important gap in our vision. We call it our blind spot. And, of course, philosophy takes that and goes in all different directions. But neurologically, that blind spot is a place where if our eyes are concentrating on it, we can't see in that spot. And the way we know that this happens is I'm sure many of us have been driving along the road, and we want to change lanes, and all of a sudden we put the blinker on, we look in the mirrors, and all of a sudden a car comes out of nowhere. We didn't even know it was there. We say it was in our blind spot. And the truth is, if you take your finger and you look at it straight ahead, you hold it in front of you.
Hold your finger. Okay, I'm going to do that.
Mm-hmm. And you look right at it, and you keep looking at it, then keep looking forward and move your finger to the side, but keep looking forward. You'll be seeing your finger out of the side of your eye and seeing it and seeing it, and suddenly it disappears.
Right. And then it picks up again?
And then you see it again. Well,
that's
your blind spot.
That's the blind spot. So when they say somebody got hit blindsided, that meant that somebody hit you from a place where you couldn't see the punch coming. You were blindsided.
That's exactly right. And actually, sometimes certain neurologic deficits or injuries to the brain cause blind spots. And we call them scotomas, for example. There are certain hemianopsias or quadrantanopsias, big medical talk for a quadrant or a fourth of your vision where you can't see.
Hmm.
And so that's a blind spot. So it's a bigger blind spot than most people have.
You know, Sherry, there are a lot of guys who are, I would call, they're perceived as dull. They kind of walk through life and they're just kind of there but not there. It's almost like they don't have the same power to observe, like a part of them is asleep. Now, a lot of people are going to relate to this because, you know, it's like there are people who don't seem to fill in the blanks. They're just walking through space, and if there's something empty, they don't care. They don't fill it in. So I wonder I can even imagine in certain levels of depression, you don't fill in the blind spots. You don't care. Filling in the blind spots is what we do when we care, when we're active, when we're trying to keep ourselves going. If we're an animal trying to survive or trying to mate, we fill in the spots. You know, so if we hear high heels, you know, and you're a young man who's looking to meet somebody, your eye kind of will turn towards it. But if you're a depressed young man, your eye will not turn towards it because you won't fill in the spot. You won't be looking to see how does this fill my picture.
That's exactly right. And your brain fills in blank spots in its visual field. And that helps you see a whole picture. You fill in the blanks, but you're absolutely right. If your brain isn't functioning to in its optimum state, then you're really not filling in the blanks, and you're not seeing the whole picture.
I wonder if we fill in the blank with all our senses. Let's think about it. You know, with touch, you want to, if you're missing, oh, yes, I had a numb finger. And I remember when that finger was numb, how it felt when I couldn't feel, where that finger didn't have the same sensation. With touch, there's always filling in some way.
And there's something called phantom limb. If you've heard of that, what people feel after they might have lost a limb in the war, for example, a soldier might have lost a limb in Vietnam or in the Gulf War, they come back and yet they feel that their arm is still there. They can even sometimes feel as if a breeze is touching their arm. And so they fill in, their brain fills in where their ability, their sensing organs in the arm are no longer there.
So what we have a reason to do this, right? Now, we know that we have the habit of doing it because it's born with us. I mean, filling in is part of what we do. But there is a reason to do it. And I'll give you an example of that. Let's just say in romance, you're sitting around, you're at work, you have a new boyfriend, you're thinking about your boyfriend, so you start romanticizing. You start creating some image about your boyfriend. What does he think of me? How does he think of me? Or wherever we do it, probably all compulsions are filling in. Wherever we cannot be quiet in our brain, we have a tendency to fill in with something. In fact, I'll bet a compulsion, an obsession, is a fill-in that's just caught on a broken track.
You know, you make me think about a song that gets stuck in your head. Sometimes.
Oh, boy, I had them.
Right? Can you? And that's happened
what
to me
so much.
What
song has been caught in your head? Tell me.
If I say the name, then I'll
then
have
you're
the
gonna
song
have
it.
Come on, say it. I'll tell you the one that got me. It was murder. What was yours?
Well, I think of that. You just sang Happy Birthday, and now I keep hearing it over and over again. Happy birthday to
you. You just keep hearing it.
I just keep hearing it. And what happens is, in the morning in particular, when I'm getting ready for work or something, if my mind isn't focused on something, I begin to hear a song over and over and over again.
I had a friend of mine who had the same, went to see a movie, and in this movie they had this song called Beautiful Maria of the Soul. With Armand Asante was in it, and I remember that. And he sang, they sang the song over and over again as if they were trying to promote the song. And it was a terrible song, but it was so there that we would joke each other. Whenever we would mention it, the brain would run through your brain. How could you not get rid of it? Because it just filled in a spot. So this is Armand DeMille with Sherry Siegel. We're talking about brain fill-in because this affects a lot of what we do. We're going to even talk about dreaming and sleeping and brain fill-in. Why does a person have bad dreams? There's a question right there. Everybody believes that dreams can be interpreted and that if you take a dream and you listen to it, you take apart all the parts, that you'll be able to figure out what you're really feeling or thinking based on what you're dreaming. What do you think? Do you think it's true? Do you think that dreams have meaning or don't have meaning? There's a number of organizations that I know that believe that dream interpretation is the only way to go. That the Jung Association, a number of other people have just basically said, if you understand the dreams, you understand the person. I have reason to doubt that because of filling in. Yesterday, as we spoke to the psychiatrist about what happens with human emotion, it turns out that we have an excited part of our brain, a part of our brain called the amygdala, and that whole system of our brain, where if it gets excited, it makes us look for danger. All you have to do is excite me, and then suddenly I'm looking for danger, because the brain gets excited, the amygdala suddenly fires, and the first thing you say to yourself is, I'm nervous, therefore there must be danger. Where is the danger? And it happens so quickly that you don't know right away. The first thing you think of, oh, the danger is I'm going to lose my job. Okay, so you're middle of the night. You suddenly wake up and you go, oh, I'm nervous. Your brain already says, where is the danger? Your brain already found a recent theme that's been running around your head. It says it must be the job, and now you're thinking about the job. And now you're nervous, and it's now associated to possibly losing the job. And then you'll tell your friend, I was up all night worrying about my job. But no, you were up all night filling in.
It makes me think about conscious memory and unconscious memory. So conscious memory, our brain brings together smells and sights and ideas and puts it all together, and it creates a memory that we can conjure when we want to, or sometimes it just comes up. But it makes me think when we're asleep, these unconscious memories are really just little pieces of information coming from different parts of the brain and coming together in a rather disorganized way, but creating something like a very fantastic story. And I think about that as being our dreams.
Floating, it's like a palette. You know, it's like little pieces of, during the course of your day, your experience, your prior experiences, it's kind of sitting around there somewhere. And your brain, because of its need to fill in, will grab pieces and put them all together. And so now you'll see a chicken with a green head. You know what I mean? Because that's why we have these distortions. I think because we're filling in, but we're not too discriminatory. We don't have to discriminate too much. We're just going to fill in with whatever is available.
Right. They say now that the brainstem just sends out a stimulus, and it's almost like shining a light in a black room. There's lots of stuff in there, but you can't really see the stuff until you shine the light. So it's almost as if the brainstem is shining a light at all these different objects or thoughts and things that are stuck around in your brain, and then at night creates dreams out of the shining the light, stimulating these different areas.
So a nightmare, just a nightmare itself, is you're nervous, and that's it. You're nervous. That's what a nightmare means. You're nervous. And then what happens is you say, so where's the danger? And then you put together some of the pieces of that which you've been dealing with lately, and then you wake up with this horrible feeling. But you have this focus. I had a dream about grandma dying, you see, and that was your nightmare. But the real thing is you were stimulated, excited, nervous, and you fetched in your brain. Oh, there was that thought you had earlier about grandma, what would happen if grandma died, right? And it fetches it, and it attaches it to the nervousness.
Exactly. It's exactly right, that the nervousness is really activation in your limbic part of your brain, the emotional part of your brain. So you're taking pictures from your visual cortex, and you're taking emotions from your limbic part of your brain, your emotional part of your brain, and you're seeing a movie that's composed of vision and feeling. And so really, that's really what dreams are about.
Vision and feeling. You told an interesting story before about a dream. One way you could look at your dreams is what you feel during the dream. So let's say you had a dream, and let's say you had a dream about a big wave, right? You're at an ocean,
yes.
And this big wave comes at you, right? Do you mind if we tell this?
Sure, that's fine.
Go ahead.
I remember this wave was something like I'd never seen before. It was really actually in a pool. A little pool in a little courtyard of a hotel. But the wave was huge. It was up to 20, 30 stories high, and it was this beautiful color of seafoam green. And it was so powerful that I couldn't forget it. It glistened.
And that was your dream.
Yes.
Then you woke up, and you talked about this, and we could find associations with waves, but the association I would find is I would say, but what did you feel as you looked at it? And you would tell me that it was a wonderful feeling. Could you describe the feeling?
It was a powerful feeling.
Yeah.
It was a beautiful, natural color. So the feelings were very positive and hopeful, optimistic.
If you could feel that way all the time, that feeling, wouldn't that be nice?
Feel great.
Wouldn't that be wonderful if life was about the big wave, you know? Because it means the way you felt when it took place. So very often what we do with dreams is we create an image that evokes in us an emotion that we want to feel. But it's really the emotion that we're going for. Think about your good dreams, your bad dreams. You know, your bad dreams are, there's an emotion that you're going to put together, but the story is not true. Now, I'm going to have to tell my story, I think.
I hope you will.
All right, here we go, making trouble. For a number of years, I worked with what's called multiple personality disorder, and I was treating people with multiple personality disorder. And those of you who don't know what it is, it means a person who has distinct personalities. They could have 5, 6, 7 different personalities. There's one main personality who is usually not aware of the others. And then there are 5 or 6 others. Usually there's one that's a child, usually one that's another sex, a different sex, usually one that's aggressive, a number of different personalities. I discovered this, and I was just shocked when I first found it. And I thought, and I went and got supervision, and I worked with this one particular patient, and I learned quite a bit about it. I learned how to access each personality. I learned through some of the techniques that I had studied that there are a way to get to each personality and speak to them individually, and that they could speak to me and trust me, and then we could have a conversation about what they were doing. Now, to give you an example of the functioning of multiple personality, I want to tell you a story about a woman who went into a grocery store. She went into a supermarket, and she was shopping, and she was dressed as an adult woman, and all of a sudden she saw some fruit cereal that she remembered as a child, and she sat down on the floor and started playing with the boxes, and she became a child. So a grown-up woman walks in a store. The next thing you know, we have this child on the floor, dressed as a grown-up woman but sitting on the floor. A young man comes along who is attracted to her and starts talking to her. She stands up and takes a very sexy, sophisticated pose. And so she's very interested in him. And the two of them go off together. They eventually travel to Europe. Eventually, she wakes up in a hotel room in London, having no idea how she got there, because the last thing she remembered was going into the grocery store. That's the way multiples do it. A multiple personality is somebody who will create gaps for you. I have at one point we're going to do a wonderful interview with a friend of mine who is a recovered, and it's just a beautiful, beautiful idea of how it works. So one of the things that happened with this person who was a multiple personality that I was working with, now it's called dissociative identity disorder, by the way, DID. I was talking to one of the personalities, and she was sitting in a chair, and I said to her, she was talking about trouble sleeping. So if she said, I have trouble eating, I would say, let me talk to the personality that chooses the food. If she said, I have trouble working, I'd say, let me talk to the working personality, because they were all different personalities. So she said, let me speak to you. I have trouble sleeping. I said, let me speak to the sleeping personality. And this personality with closed eyes appears, and starts talking to me in a very somber voice. And I said, who are you? And she says, I live in the dark. She says, I am the person who dreams. I'm the one who dreams. But I said, wait a minute, doesn't she do the dreaming? Don't you all do the dreaming? And she said, no, I take fragments of whatever happens during the day, and I create it into a dream. And I said, but you can't, why are your eyes closed? And she said, but I never see anything because I'm blind. I'm on the inside. I function in darkness. She said, so I don't see anything. It's just what I make up. Therefore, if I imagine somebody, I can't imagine them exactly. I could just imagine them in the only way I perceived it. So I was shocked by listening to this. In fact, I encouraged the person to open her eyes, which she did. And a short while later, the patient came back to me with a complaint that she couldn't sleep anymore. And I said, why? So I accessed the sleeping personality, the dreaming personality. And I said, why can't she sleep? She said, because her eyes are open. So I had to get her to close her eyes again. Now, this may sound wacky, but let me tell you, I have been through a lot of doing therapy, and this is what happens when you work with people with this kind of unique talent. What is dissociative identity disorder? What is multiple personality disorder? It's filling in. It's filling in with a personality where there's an uncomfortable feeling, an emotion that you can't and don't want to feel. So one of the things that happened with this was now we had a challenge. If the person who is doing the dreaming is not the real person asleep. Is that what everybody does? So I grabbed a whole group of people, and I asked people to go into an experiment, and we did an experiment where I suggested to everyone that they access their dreaming personality, and they all could. So now this is very, very funny. We now have, wait, isn't it true I'm dreaming? Well, this, if it were true, meant that all theory about dream interpretation is hogwash, because it's not you doing the dreaming, but your other guy. And not only that, but you're all carrying around an alter personality, and everybody has one, and it's the one that dreams. So, Sherry, you've got another Sherry inside you who's doing the dreaming, and I have another Armand who's doing the dreaming. It's not me. When they say, I can't fall asleep and dream, I think it's I've got to let myself give it up so that the other guy could take over, if it's a guy.
Maybe it can be both the Armand that we see and talk to and the Armand who goes to sleep. So rather than either or.
Well, I don't see the problem. The question is, the Armand who is dreaming is not the Armand we see, is what I proved. Anyway, this got much bigger, of course, and there were a couple of articles written about it, which if anybody wants to see, I'll show you. And the articles, therefore, now became a big deal, because now everybody who made a living doing dream interpretation wanted to challenge me on it, and I gave it up because I said, well, I don't really want to be in this fight. But it was a fascinating thing, because here we are talking about dreams and dream interpretation. What do you make out of your dreams? And in fact, I want to ask you, the audience, to be calling us in later with a dream that sounds significant, right? I want to show you what happens when you say a dream. Now, here's what's going to happen. When you tell us your dream, we're going to be bored, because you're going to have details in your dream that are nothing to us but have meaning to you. And as you try to, you ever listen to somebody telling you about their dream? You sometimes, well, I don't need to know that it was a red striped tablecloth. I don't need to know, but it's important to you because it was part of the detail. So I'm going to ask people to call in with some dream anecdotes.
You know, and it's really hard to tell someone your dream. I don't know if you've noticed that, but for me, when I dream, I dream kind of strange. Things jump from one thing to another. It doesn't seem to flow like a real story does. So sometimes it's hard to tell someone your dreams.
We used to be training, when I was training in my early therapy training, we were told that when you wake up, you write down your dream. Because within 15 minutes, the dream is going to change. And if you go to your therapist and you try to report your dream to your therapist, it'll be totally different than what you dreamed last night. That you have to write it down immediately. So we had little recorders that we used to do, voice recorders. You wake up and you say what you dreamed right away. Which reminds me of Yossarian in Catch-22. In Catch-22, Yossarian goes to the psychiatrist and he tells the psychiatrist, I dreamed about fish. And the psychiatrist said, that's a sex dream. And then he said, he goes back the next day and says, I had another dream about fish. And the psychiatrist says, that's a sex dream. And he goes back the third time and he says, ah, finally, I dreamed about sex. And the psychiatrist said, that's a fish dream. This is Armand DeMille with you with The Positive Mind. So do get your calls together. I'm going to play you some very interesting, strange music today, just so that you could hear some dreamy tones. And keep in mind, we do have that project for possibly part-time bookkeeper. We're looking for somebody who might want that. And you can do that by just getting in touch with us by email. So we're going to take a short break. And when we come back, my friends, we are going to do more of this stuff. We're going to be taking your calls about your dreams. Interesting stuff, don't you think?
Yes.
We'll be back with you in just a couple of minutes. Mm-hmm. It is interesting, isn't it?
Fascinating.
The Dakshini Ensemble. Mm. Kinsmen. Yeah. What about auditory filling in, Sherry?
Armand, there's a study from the Netherlands where a doctor looked at filling in brain sounds. Very, very interesting. What he says is that it's common for us to hear sounds that aren't really there. Humans hearing a constructive process, for example, during a conversation. Sometimes they may hear a word or two and fill in the blanks, and sometimes they believe people, in fact, people with certain brain disorders like schizophrenia fill in the blanks. Sometimes they believe people are talking to them. They may hear bits and pieces of commercials or conversations and believe that people are actually addressing them. And so their brain does the work of filling in the gaps.
So one wonders why the gaps exist. Why do some people fill in the gaps and other people just don't fill in the gaps? What do you think? To me, I think it's you've got to be okay with silent moments. Some people have got themselves so regimented, so controlling, so busy, and I don't mean that as a criticism, so active that if there's a quiet moment, they don't know what to do with it. They fill it in.
You're right. It's almost humans doing instead of human beings.
Yeah.
There's something that always has to be happening. So if there's no activity in front of them, if nothing is planned, they have to come up with activities.
Got to do something, which is why we have TVs and computers and
right. Everything
else and every active. And every child nowadays, every young person is walking around with either headphones or heroin.
Or sometimes the radio is always on, for example, in my house, in my car. It's my constant companion, and it seems to fill in the gap. Sometimes when I turn the radio off, it feels very quiet. It feels very silent. It's a little lonely.
We have a thing in radio called dead air. It's a big threat. You know, you should never have dead air. It's like, oh. If we had dead air right now, if I did a minute of dead air, we would probably go off. You know, the station would probably disconnect us because something's got to be wrong. You should never have dead air.
Because they don't know you're there.
They don't know if something's wrong or not. But you see, there's the same thinking. If it's dead air, then something may be wrong. If you don't hear, if your boyfriend doesn't write to you and your girlfriend doesn't write to you and you don't hear from them, what's wrong? Nowadays, cell phones, right? Used to be beepers, right? Now cell phones. Oh, my gosh. Text messaging is all about filling in. It's nervous kids filling in the spaces. And text messaging to the point where they just can't stop. It's just over and over again. As a young girl said to one of our people, she said, "Mama, please take this away. Please take my text messaging away. I can't stop."
But isn't it something we've taught the kids to do?
Yes. That
they always have to be stimulated. Something has to always be happening.
So doing. Maybe we, as parents, can show that some quiet time may be of value. Maybe. I'm not so sure. Some time when we're just sitting around being quiet. You know what? You know, I'll bet that's what the idea of a prayer before dinner was. You know, you're about to have dinner. Okay, let's say grace. Right? Well, if you're not religious, there was something very mighty about holding everybody's hand for a minute.
It was bringing you into the present.
Yeah, just let go of everything.
And really, that's what meditation is about, too. It's about stepping out of the mind stream and just being in the moment, feeling your breathing, feeling your hands touching something, your rear end in the chair supporting you. Listening, noticing the sounds around you, but not engaging. Just noticing.
But yes, and I noticed that too, and I think that that's a bridge to it. But I think that's also filling in. Because being without feeling your hands, without noticing the sounds, right, that's another level of it. We could train ourselves there. Why don't you and I do a study on this, Sherry? You know, we're going to try to see where we could create blank spots. And we'll do an experiment on blankness. Nothing.
Reading between the lines.
Yeah, I remember once I was doing an experiment with trying to not do anything because I was such a busy guy. And I remember I was sitting in a chair and I was doing nothing, absolutely nothing. I was so proud of myself. And a friend called me up and said, "Hey, what are you doing?" I said, "Nothing." And he said, "Oh, I'll be right over." I said, "No, no, no, no." No, you have to understand, I'm doing nothing. Let's take one of our calls, 212-209-2900. That's 212-209-2900.
Nope.
Okay, so what we're going to do is open to you dream anecdotes. What kind of dreams do you have? Now, one of the things, one of the skills we have, since we are saying that you make up your dreams out of empty space, and that dreams have very little significance.
Okay.
You know, what we're going to talk about is how you could alter the dreams themselves. Let's take a call. Hi, you're on the air. This is Armand DeMille.
Oh, hi, Armand. I had a dream just about in the past 2 weeks. Very, very frightening. And I think I know why I dreamt it in a way. Well, the dream was this. I'm on 37th Avenue in Jackson Heights where I live. I'm walking down the street, and I notice there's a big brown bear on all fours, and he's walking very fast down 37th, and it's just terrifying. The terrifying part are his paws. He's got these huge paws, and he's, like, touching the pavement, and it was absolutely just terrifying.
Right. Okay, now, what you're saying is you had a dream, and did you wake up in terror?
I did wake up in terror.
Very nervous.
Oh, terrifying, as if, yeah, I just had to, like, I felt like my heart could just stop just from the terror.
Right. Now, one person would say, you're dreaming about it because you're dealing with things in your life that are frightening you. And the other person would say, well, things in your life are not frightening you that much. But that time, that night, your brain gave off a signal and your amygdala fired. And you said, oh, what is it? I must be scared. And you went and you fetched for a few things. Now, just if you would, give me what the symbols are.
I don't know the brown bear symbol. I know this much, that I remember in real life, 2 years ago on Halloween, right on 37th Avenue, there was a man dressed up, not as a bear, he was dressed up in combat uniform, and he had like a big fake machine gun, and he was standing like a few feet in front of me, and I remember feeling this terror, as if, oh my God, how terrifying it must be if that was really the case, and it was the same kind of terror that I felt in the dream.
Perfect. So what does that mean? It just means that the terror you felt back then went into the recesses of your mind as a memory. And then when you got excited in the middle of the night, some part of you said, oh, what could be scaring us so much? And you recalled it with a little shift.
Right.
You changed it into a brown bear.
That's right. And also I remember another association. I think it was last summer, the summer before, we went to a zoo around in Washington, D.C. They have a beautiful zoo. And I remember they had a tank with a polar bear. Like usually you see the polar bear from the ground, but here, since they like the water, you go and see them in the tank, and all you could see was the paw of the polar bear. And I remember feeling, ooh, how scared, not terrified, but I remember how weird it looked, just seeing, you just look out at this tank, and all you see is this paw or whatever. It was very scary, and that was the association too also.
Yeah. So that, too, went into your memory bank of when I get afraid of things, let me recall some of the things that frightened me.
Also, yeah.
Thank you so much.
About water when I was
Wait. Let me take some of the other calls,
all right,
okay?
Thank you. Bye.
Thank you so much for calling. Sure. So we go. Things that scare us go into the memory file of potential fear. Now, this makes sense because if you're a deer drinking water, you're going to remember that there are certain birds that could eat your babies. Right? You have to be careful not to have these big hawks come down when you have babies down there. You've got to be afraid of lions and tigers. You have to be afraid of the bears. That you have in your mind somewhere, there's an image. Mankind, you have an image. The sound of a gun, you know? The thing that got Mama Bambi, you know? You have these things in your mind. If you saw the movie Bambi, then if you're a deer and you saw the movie Bambi, my poor mind. Okay, So you have these associations, and the minute you feel a chill, the minute you feel nervous, it's going to call for it. It's going to say, where is it? Who is it? It's one of these things. And very often it'll combine five of them. And then you'll try to make sense of them by interpreting them, and that's a lost cause.
It's almost as if you have a file cabinet of scary stuff.
That's right. Good.
And so when your brain feels frightened, it goes into the file cabinet. Well, I'm frightened of guns or frightened of a bear. What is it tonight? One of them will jump out.
And you know, that's a very interesting thing, Sherry. What am I frightened of? What things scare me? You know, what kind of things? I have little things. I was like cockroaches when I was a kid. I got you with cockroaches, right?
It's not. I don't mind the bigger insects. I don't mind them too much. I don't like ants.
Ants. Oh, you have ants. See? And you got that creepy thing. So that could come up and get you at any point.
Yeah.
Right? And rats, that can come up and get me at any point. And screaming can come up and get me at any point. Yeah, interesting. 212-209-2900, our file drawer of terrors. Let's take another call. Hi, you're on the air. Thank you very much. You know, I'm going to say something about that, by the way. You know, the Shinnecock Indians, who in Long Island have been a tribe that had mostly the property around the university. And I've visited them a number of times. And they've been trying to get recognition for years as an authentic tribe. 25 years they've been fighting for it, for their authenticity. And I, being an advocate, said they've got to get recognized. And finally, they got their recognition. And the first thing they're going to do is build a casino. I guess they're filling in, right? Because a casino in New York is the idea of why the petition was granted. What's the matter with us? Casinos and noise and gambling, it's all filling in. You know, OTB is filling in. Lottery is filling in. Poor us, the quiet mind.
Very little. There really is very little. That we look for, we look for activity. We don't look for nothing. And in some ways, you know, we've heard the expression, nature abhors a vacuum. Well, even our brains seem to seek activity, whether it's visual activity or thought activity. And we have to really make a conscious effort to step back from it. Like you took that effort the day, you said, I'm doing nothing. But even then,
you're
doing something, and things come up. And I can imagine that sitting there trying to do nothing becomes an activity in itself.
Well, it is an activity. I can tell you. I mean, I know a lot of people are going to say, oh, no, I could do it. I could just sit back and do nothing. I remember I was 20 years old. I had a psychiatrist. I wanted to see the psychiatrist. I went to this guy who was a psychiatrist who I liked, who trained me. And I said to him, I want you to sit there and just watch me because I'm going to do and think about nothing. And I was afraid that if I stopped my brain, something would happen to me. And he said, okay. Now, he was a physician. He currently, if I died, he would bring me back. Or if I passed out, he would give me something. And I remember paying him, it was $75 an hour at the time, I was paying him to do nothing. And there I was, because I didn't want him to do anything, and I was going into my nothingness, and I'm going into my nothingness, and I opened my eyes, and he was making his laundry list, which made sense to me. But then, of course, I used that as an obsession as to why I can't go into nothing. All of us will find a reason to fill in. One of the things we're going to learn about, my friends, is that to not fill in is probably an interesting place to look. We looked into the abyss, and we saw the abyss looking back at us. 212-209-2900, this is Armand DeMille. Let's take another call. Hi, you're on the air.
Hi, my name's Anna, and I love your show, Armand and Sherry. It's fabulous. I had a dream a long, long time ago when I was 16 years old, and I'm 61 years old now. And it was what I always thought of as a near-death experience, which literally changed my life spiritually. Later, I had another real near-death experience based on a physical situation where I was almost suffocated by a very, very steamy shower, and it was similar, it had a similar effect on me. The dream was simple. I was walking out into a beautiful, beautiful sandbar that went very, very far, and it reminded me of a place on the Cape Cod that I used to go to with a long sandbar. And I was drawn to the beauty of the sky and the sea and the endlessness of it, which I loved anyway in real life. But I was walking out really far in this shallow water and suddenly saw a huge tidal wave coming towards me. And it kind of startled me, and I realized that I was not going to survive because I would not be able to run back to land fast enough, and that I would be crushed. But what happened to me at the age of 16 in this dream was that I suddenly saw my life flash in front of me, and I knew that I wouldn't be able to do all the things that I was looking forward to doing, like traveling, going to college, going to Europe, having a car. And this deep feeling came forward and said, it doesn't matter at all. And I was released, literally released from all those cravings that really carried over into my life.
Wow.
And then later, I had a real near-death experience when I was living on an island in Spain and taking a very hot shower in a barber shop. And literally, I was just about suffocated. I managed to open the bolt lock just in time and found myself later. I drifted into this beautiful space where these heavenly celestial voices were welcoming me back. But then the barber had wrapped me up in a barber sheet, taken me in a taxi to a clinic, and somehow I revived. But I feel like I was floating into a place where I was dying. But it was left me with the same feeling of a beautiful connection with a much big loving energy that really has stayed with me to the point where I don't feel like I'm afraid of death, and I feel very connected to a very vast loving being or presence. And anyway, I really connect those two experiences, and I'm finding your show so fascinating because I think you're talking about death in a way.
Yep.
Too. So I'd love to hear your comment.
Well, first of all, Anna, let's go back a second. You're 16 years old.
I was 16 when I had the first dream.
Yeah, 16 years old. At this point, what's changed for you? Certainly you're becoming an adult. Certainly you're changing as a woman. You're becoming this kind of being. You're no longer an adolescent, no longer a child, and you're becoming this being who's beginning to see her own world as opposed to the world of your parents or the people who brought you up.
Yes, definitely.
And you have this exquisite dream of letting go. And you talk about what we're talking about, which is you created an empty space. You walked out on the sandbar, and it was endless, and it was further and further, and your mind was getting quieter and quieter and quieter and quieter, and you're walking off, as if we're saying you're letting yourself leave. And
absolutely.
Then what the mind will do is it will find a way to stop you. It will say, let me give you something to be scared about. Like, what's to be afraid about? Okay, let's open up the chest and look. And so we create a tidal wave that comes after you just to scare you and energize you a little bit. But the way you handle it is to somehow include it, and your transformation starts to take place. Anytime we get into anything, I mean, you talk about even the steam thing that happened when you were later, you know, when you, with right. that near death. Anytime we get suspended and there's no chance to think, we get a chance to touch that realm. And I think there's some prohibition. I think there's something up there that says we don't want people to be aware of their God self. We don't want people, because these people have got to do everything else. They've got to get competitive. They've got to be afraid of each other. But I think there's some prohibition against really actualizing and feeling this level of connection with the universe that you have. Some of us fight for it, and we make it happen. Others have it happen just by accident, like you did as well. And some of us just wait till we get a little older, because the beauty of it is, one of the beauties of being a little older is when you have the smile that says, oh, all that stuff to worry about, you don't have to worry about it.
And really your own mechanism to survive seemed to pick its head up and say, I'm going to make it through.
Not even survive. She was thriving. She went even further. It wasn't about survival. It doesn't matter, right?
It went through the danger into the zone of being back in control.
Yeah, so what if I die? Right? So what?
Right. And, you know, the beauty is that it carried through into my life. And later I met a very wonderful teacher from India and really was open and ready for that. And that was a long, beautiful experience too. But I don't know if I would have been receptive if it weren't for that initial dream.
So creating the gaps is where it all starts, I believe. Finding the quiet space.
What a wonderful show. What a wonderful show. And I hope you do the study on blankness. Don't we need that so
Yes,
much?
We will. Okay, we'll follow up with that. Thanks for calling in, Anna.
Thanks so much.
16 to 61. You notice the numbers reversed?
That's right. I didn't notice.
16, then she was 61.
Very observant.
212-209-2900. One more call, and then we have to go. This is Armand DeMille. Hi, you're on the air.
Hello, am I actually on the air?
Yes, you are actually on the air.
Yes, I love your show, and I thank you so much for taking my call. You always inspire me to do better, so I just wanted to say that first. What I wanted to talk about is that recently I've been having a series of dreams that have been scary, and they all have to do with relationships. In my dreams recently, I've been involved with men that are physically abusive or following me or chasing me, and the one that I wanted to express was the one where a young man had intended to rape me, and he didn't, only because I showed him that I was having my monthly friend. I was able to run away from him. As I was running down the stairs, I saw my mother, who was also running after me with a box. I ran away from her, and I ran into this room, which was a meeting. It was like a conference. And I sat on a table next to two other women, and there was a sign that said entertainment business or entertainment marketing. And when I woke up, I thought, that's where I want to be, continuing with my entertainment business. But I felt like I had to run away from everything else.
Yeah.
And in my dreams recently, it's always been me about going back to past relationships and seeing myself or running.
Well, you know, I wish we had more time, because I would love to go into that one a little further. But it seems clear, you know, the past relationships are in the drawer of things that scare you. Sexuality scares you. Probably your period even scared you. Your mother scares you, you know. Being accountable scares you. And all of those go in the drawer. And what happens is you get to a certain place in life where you get a certain sensation, the amygdala gets fired. And the next thing you know, you're out there and you're thinking about this stuff. You're just dreaming about it. And it's as if it's real.
And to me, it seemed like you ran away from stuff that wasn't in your best interest
towards
something that is your life's desire.
Thanks for calling in. Hey, this is Armand DeMille with you with The Positive Mind with Dr. Sherry Siegel. Thanks again, Sherry.
Thank you, Armand.
We will be back with you again tomorrow at 1 p.m. with more stuff, my friends. Send us an email. Go to thepositivemind.com. Be back with you soon.